Amateur Traveler, episode 829. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about the Coral Triangle, Coast Watchers and Coconut Crabs, Sing Sings, Shell Money, and PT-109 as we go to Melanesia. I'm Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler. Let's talk about Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and Vanuatu. I'd like to welcome back to the show Sherry Ott from ottsworld.com. Sherry has been a guest on the show many times. Always a pleasure, Sherry. Welcome back. And you've got a different and a little more exotic destination for us this time.
Yes, I do. First of all, thanks for having me back, as always. I love being on your show. And yes, I have gone very remote, which makes me very happy. It's my favorite type of travel to do is remote expedition type travel. And today I'm going to be talking about the remote areas of Melanesia and how I got to them recently and was able to see the three countries of Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and Vanuatu.
Excellent. So we're in the Pacific. We're trying to put it on a map. Yes, I think people got it once you
Pacific.
Said the countries. But when you said Melanesia, I don't know that I would have been able to find that on a map.
I know. It is weird. I don't think most Americans probably know too much about Melanesia, but you've had shows before on Micronesia, maybe Polynesia. It's kind of Polynesia, Micronesia, Melanesia make up that whole South Pacific. My understanding is they were split up into these groups because they had similar cultures.
Right.
And that's how they were split into the three areas. So this covers Melanesia, which of course, yes, it's southern hemisphere. It is northeast of Australia. And it's thousands of islands and island
right.
change that also make up these. It's actually four countries, technically. The fourth country is Fiji that
okay.
it would include. But I did not go to Fiji on this trip. Yeah, it is. It's a really fascinating little part of the world that is very hard to get to.
Excellent. Why should someone go to Melanesia?
Oh, there's a few reasons. One is culture, by far. If you are into visiting places with culture that is vastly different than our own, that is very remote and untouched, but yet open to tourism, that right there is, for me, number one and why I went. It's also a part of what they call the Coral Triangle.
Okay,
so
that's where
like
all the coral disappears in the coral triangle.
Quite the opposite.
Okay,
it's where sorry. All the coral grows. I think they said like 75% of the world's shallow water reef-building coral is located there.
Hmm.
So that means really great snorkeling, like
okay.
beautiful snorkeling, as well as diving. We stuck to snorkeling, though. So if you are an underwater enthusiast, this is a great place to go.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a birder, this is a wonderful place to go. Now, I am not a birder, but there were a lot of birders with me, and I find them fascinating. That's an interesting culture in and of itself. But they've got hundreds and thousands of unique bird varieties there, and they are hard to find because dense jungle on remote islands. So very rare birds to be found there. And then finally, this was a surprise for me slightly, is you go there if you want to learn more about World War II history.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I don't think I learned very much about the South Pacific World War II goings on when I was in school. It was mainly focused in Europe, I think is what we learned. But oh my goodness, there was a lot of action there. And there's so much World War II history. Plenty of it has to do with the U.S. John
right.
F. Kennedy's ship was sunk there. So a lot of that stuff I didn't know. You also learn a lot about the Australian and New Zealand armies and so on. So there
right.
are bunkers and World War II sites and all kinds of stuff around there too. So something for
My
everyone.
Father's older brother, as I understand it, fought with MacArthur in the New Guinea campaign and then up into the Philippines. That was the first thing for me is... And of course, Guadalcanal is part of the Solomon Islands, which if you're a World War II history buff, that is something you know.
Yes, that is true, which I did not probably. I learned a lot about World War II history. So that was really fun. And that was a little bit of a surprise for me because I was really going for the culture. And all the other things were just extras, but I fell in love with it. It was fascinating. It is a trip that really satiates your curiosity if you're one of those curious travelers.
Excellent. So we're going to recommend that when people start traveling, they go to that London and Paris trip first, and their second trip will be to Melanesia.
Yes. It'll be vastly different.
And you did this on a small boat.
I did.
It's a little longer itinerary than we normally cover. We normally focus on a 1 to 2 week, just because of the length of the show, if nothing else, and because of Americans' vacation time. But this was a 17-day or 17-night trip.
17-night trip on a small ship. Now, it's an expedition ship, which is, well, small ship. So I will say there was, it holds 120 passengers and about 80 crew. Our particular trip was, because I think still the cruise industry is a little bit slow to get started in COVID, as well as this is a pretty unusual and remote, unique destination. We had, I want to say, 80 passengers and about 20 expedition staff. And then there was about 80 crew on the ship. This ship is a new ship for Heritage Expeditions. That's who I went with. They are a company based out of New Zealand, and they're family owned, which this is my third trip I took with them. And that's how much I love them. They do expedition travel right. So anyway, this is a new ship that they acquired over the pandemic, which is a little bit bigger than their past expedition ships. But it's comfortable, but it's not like big cruise ship. It's not like those thousand people ships. Right. This is meant for exploration in a comfort way.
So no dinner show, no casino, no art auction.
No, food was great. We were fed wonderfully. It was comfortable. You said it was, it's 17 days. So it was comfortable to be on the ship, but it was long because these places, like I said, they're hard to get in and out of. So there's only X amount of places where they can dock and get us in and out at airports and stuff like that. So part of it is long because of the fact that of where you're at.
Right.
But it was really cool because you did get to travel through three countries in their little remote islands. So we actually started in Papua New Guinea, which is probably the most developed out of any of those, and flew into Port Moresby, and then over to, we took a charter flight to Madang, and that's where we got on the ship. And then we ended up flying out of Vanuatu at Port Vila.
Okay. So you're doing kind of northwest to southeast, if I've got that correctly. Yeah.
Very
okay.
good. Yeah. So it was great. And I think expedition travel is different than a regular cruise.
I love it personally. Yeah. Obviously you do as well. So.
Oh my God, it's my favorite kind of travel. And it is really a niche of travel.
A little more expensive.
Yes, it is.
When you get off the great big ships, your cost per night per person is going to go up.
Yes. And also because they are going to these remote areas that are hard to get to. They're exotic areas for wildlife. When you think of expedition travel, you probably think of like Antarctica, Galapagos, Alaska, we talked about. You've been to those places. Mm-hmm. And yes, to get to some of those really beautiful remote places, you're going by small ship. So this is the same idea, basically.
Right.
I think the one thing, if you're thinking about expedition travel, that you have to allow for flexibility. That is the key that defines expedition travel to me. It's normally around wildlife, remote places. You need to be flexible because things change all the time. In fact, our expedition leader always says you have to be rigidly flexible, which is great. Or you just have to be able to know that you're going to have an itinerary and it might not stick on it.
The way they say that on cruise, which I've done a couple times, is we change for weather, whim, and wildlife.
which is great.
So here's our itinerary.
You just have to know that.
Until it isn't.
Exactly. And we had a few places that we couldn't visit that were on the itinerary because there was tribal warring going on.
Well.
We had to revert to some other island, and it went perfectly. And that's what makes a really good crew who can make those changes quickly and figure out other things kind of thing.
And the advantage that an expedition class ship has is they're usually bringing your entertainment along, which is your scuba gear and your kayaks if you've got it, or your hike. So it's not like they have to rebook your zip line experience when you get there, or your catamaran trip, or the kind of shore excursions that you would have on a big ship, because the expedition ship is its, your entertainment is active, and it's the naturalist that you've got with you that knows that is that particular rare bird and all that kind of stuff. So that you can go to that island versus this island and not have to rearrange with a lot of other people.
Yeah.
With a port, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
Assuming like, you're going into port, and they don't always even go into port.
Oh, we were only in port for one when we got on in Madang. We didn't even end in port in Vanuatu. Yeah, that's the other thing about it, too. You need to be flexible in how you travel, but also you need to be slightly active because you are getting on and off.
I was gonna, you need to be able to get in and out of a Zodiac, right?
Yeah, in a big swell.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Or there were a couple places where we, in order to get up into the highlands to meet a tribe or to be welcomed into a tribe, we had to ride, as they called it, our local air-conditioned transportation, which was literally in the back of a pickup truck. Like all of So you have to be also slightly dangerous in that sense, too.
Right. Let's talk a little more about your itinerary. We're going to have to sample it a bit, I think, just for time.
Yeah.
But what should we know about this itinerary? You started in Papua New Guinea.
Started in Papua New Guinea. I think the big thing to know is like these four areas that we talked about, culture, history, wildlife, that type of stuff, and snorkeling. But it's really the culture. So what we would do is we would pull up to an island on Zodiacs, and each tribe or each village would normally have some sort of welcome. The traditional thing they call a sing sing, which is basically their oral history told through song and dance. And you probably know that these regions are famous for their headhunting past.
Yeah.
Which is really fascinating.
In the past, yeah.
Yes. Not so far in the past, but past, yes.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of interesting. So we got to see, what do I want to say, remnants of some of that. Like every time we pull up to an island, there would be some sort of welcome slash, what would I say? Kind of felt like you were in a haunted house. Like they would come running out at you with spears and so on. Just to mimic. Yeah. Just to mimic. That's how it used to be. They were trying to figure out if you were friend or foe. Anyway, it was always interesting, sometimes funny, but really interesting. And then you would normally get welcomed onto the island by the chiefs and the elders. Mm-hmm. And there would be various flowers and things. You were blessed with, I don't know, branches and so on. And then they would put on a sing sing performance. And that generally was either groups of women, school children, groups of men doing specific performances about life in the village. I didn't always understand them, but they were fascinating because of the dress. It's elaborate, colorful dress.
It was, right.
They use all the natural things around them, right? So it was really cool. And then after the sing-sings and so on, they would have little guides that would walk you around the village and you could see how they lived. Ask questions, as many questions as you wanted, maybe get a chance to taste their food, go in their homes, et cetera. And that was the typical village visits that we would do.
Okay.
And you would think that would get old after 17 days, but it never got old because every place was so different.
It's so different. What kind of things would be different?
Some of it was the type of music. Like one of the things that I thought was really interesting.
Did that change as you got further away from, for instance, from New Guinea and got into different?
That's a good question. It changed. Yeah, I would say a little bit. It depended on whichever island we were landing on. How close was that maybe to a bigger island that had kind of structure on it? So it ranged from, there was one island we went to that they actually had an amplifier and a bass player. I'm like, wow, where did that come from?
The because traditional, most of the, yeah.
But they were still dressed in the traditional dress and they had their regular kind of like bamboo instruments, but it was accompanied by a bass and a guitarist, which I thought was really interesting. So that was the most advanced, the most remote music instruments that we had were just Like there was one tribe that had banana leaves folded up really densely, and they would just hit them and it would create this interesting echo or sound, kind of thump. Okay. And they would have different sizes. So that was really simple and plain. And then there was a tribe that had taken bamboo. This is pretty typical, but had taken all these bamboo logs and made them pipes, obviously, in different sizes. And whether they were blowing into them, which would sound like a flute or something.
Sure.
Or I loved this. They made them all these different sizes and diameters and put them all together like a, like a xylophone or something.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah, I got you.
But then they had these little rubber paddles that they would hit and play, kind of like a xylophone. Mm-hmm. But it was so intricate, and there were so many, and there were harmonies going on, and they had done all these different size bamboos and so on to make that work. So it was really cool. And the cool thing was the rubber that they used to the paddles were flip-flops, were like the bottoms of shoes and flip-flops.
Huh. It wasn't the flip-flops from previous expeditions that had been there that had been less successful.
I do not know that.
Okay. That would be a good thing to know.
And then finally, and this was in Vanuatu, we had a group of women that came and performed for us, and their instrument was the ocean, which was fascinating. They walked into the ocean, and they basically, by the way in which they slapped and cupped the water, it makes different notes, like really cool kind of bass tones and so on. And then they would sing to it, but it was like a whole rhythm. The slapping and the bass tones were so cool. And then they tried to teach us, and we did not do that nearly as well. I guess it just goes to show you, like, they make the best with whatever they have.
Sure.
So these women, these water performers, basically just came up with this because they were out washing the clothes in the river. All the women go and wash clothes in the river, and they came up with the fact that, hey, this makes different sounds, and they started experimenting around with it, and the whole water music thing was born.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so lots of different kinds of music like that. So everything was a little different. And then I think from a cultural perspective, every town was a little bit different in the sense that if you have a spectrum, and on the far spectrum might be Hawaii, where you go to a luau and they dress in the skirts and they do the music and then they get in their Toyota and drive home. It is a show very specifically just put on for that moment. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there was a tribe that we visited in the Solomon Islands called the Kwai tribe. And they were on that far end of still wore their traditional dress. It wasn't just for us. And they came down from the highlands. It took them 2 days to come meet our ship. And it was really, and there is not a lot that they're dressed in. Let me tell you that first of all. Anyway, they came down, and this is like historically one of the biggest like warring tribes in this region. There's been a lot written about the Kauai people and some of the most vicious, basically. But we met the chief. They've started to westernize slightly and starting to build more facilities in their village and so on. But they came down to demonstrate how they lived and so on. So they did some cooking demonstrations and stuff like that. And then we were going to do the Sing Sing. But the thing with them was they protect, kind of like a trademark, they protect their dances. They don't want other people to see them. And if you're going to participate, then you have to respect their culture or the way that they do it.
Sure.
And you need to dress in their tribal dress and use their instruments. So that was really interesting. Whoever wanted to participate could participate. And I basically wore a little tiny blue loincloth in front, and that was it. No pictures, obviously, were allowed. But then they gave us the little instruments and we could participate with them. It was very basic and one of the craziest things I've done. But really interesting, too. So you have those on that spectrum of very still stuck back in that older time, I would say.
Right.
And then you've got this in between. And all the villages that we visited and the cultures were somewhere along that spectrum. Yeah. So that was the song and dance. The other thing that I thought was really fascinating from a cultural perspective was the currency. So lots of these islands, because they're so remote, they didn't have a way to get like metals out of the ground and melt them down. So there's no coins. But still today, they have these alternative forms of currency called shell money. And they also have something called red feather money and some other stuff. They also trade in pigs. There's a lot of trading and stuff going on still. So it's really crazy. Like, you could actually use this shell money at markets and buy bananas and so on. So really different. But one of the places that struck me was also in the Solomon Islands, a village on the island of Nendo, in a village called Noipe. We had to take one of those crazy truck rides for an hour up into the highlands, and the village welcomed us / scared us. And one of the big things there that it's the only place you'll find in the world is called this red feather money. In fact, most of the places you see it will be in museums because it's very rare, but they still make it there. And in fact, we got to see a demonstration. So they, like I said, they didn't have ore to make coins, but they did have something else that was rare, which was these bird feathers. It was the, I'm trying to find the name of the scarlet honey eater bird, this cute little red bird. And they basically, this was slightly disturbing, but they basically take the feathers, each little individual tiny like tweezer-like feather off the bird or off some of the birds, and they glue them onto these kind of wooden strips that look like a belt, and they end up in a coil. And then it ends up as this, it looks like from a distance, it just looks like a red belt, and they coil it up and the women wear it on their head. It can take a year to make, and it's specialists in the village that like do all the placement of the feathers. And then it's used as currency more as a, what I would call a bride gift or a bride price, you'll hear.
Okay.
I think it's the only bird currency in the world or something. I don't know, but very different, let me tell you. That tribe in and of itself was really interesting. They did a lot of piercings and paint and so on and so forth for their sing sing. But I thought that the red feather money was fascinating to me. All of these different currencies were fascinating because it's so different to us. They didn't have Bitcoin. So yeah, that was, the currency stuff is really different.
So you said there were four different elements, and that gives us an idea of the cultural element.
Yes.
We also had snorkeling.
Yeah, lots of great snorkeling. One of my favorite snorkeling area was an area off the Solomon Islands called Tetapare Island. Tetapare is famous. There's actually a book written about it that you can find on Amazon, which is surprising. But Tetapare is the largest uninhibited island in the world.
Uninhabited.
Yes, sorry. Let me say that again.
It sounded like a few of the islands you went to were fairly uninhibited.
That too. Tetapare is the largest uninhabited island in the world.
Okay.
And it's uninhabited. It used to be inhabited hundreds of years ago.
Okay.
But they don't actually know why it's no longer inhabited. They could be headhunters. Could have been disease. It's not really sure. But then no one was there. There was some coconut farmers coming in. Then there was some logging that wanted to come in. But luckily, the people stopped that. And they actually saved that island for conservation. So it is a kind of a well-known, in that region at least, conservation island. And it has a beautiful reef off of it that drops off. And so that was probably my favorite snorkeling place. The other thing about that area around that island is they do turtle conservation. So there are a healthy group of hawksbill and green turtles that are being tagged and studied around the area. So the island itself and the surrounds, basically the surrounding reefs, are being watched over by, I think it's 12 rangers that kind of live there on and off. There is a tiny little eco lodge there. And when I say lodge, hut, there's no running water or electricity. There's no running water or electricity in any of these places. So it's basic, but if you are looking for a kind of a really cool eco experience, Tetapare is a neat place. And that is one of those places that in the Solomon Islands where you actually don't need to go on an expedition cruise to get there. It's going to take you a long time to get there, but there's an airstrip at a nearby island and then you have to boat over, but you can actually stay there. So that's a little bit different. And then you can participate in citizen science stuff. So while we were there, they did some of the turtle tagging.
Okay.
They do measurements and they tag them and so on, and then let them go to enjoy that lovely reef. And then we also did some hiking there on the island, as well as became acquainted with the coconut crab, which looks like a giant, terrifying spider when it first comes out. Yeah, I didn't know what it was at first. It's just, it's a crab, but it's big and it's brown. And so it just looked like a spider the size of a soccer ball, honestly. And then it started walking around and it looked way more crab-like. Anyway, so the coconut crabs there are protected and they are very large and they live in the ground. They do not go in the water, apparently. And they can crack a coconut. They're the only crab that can crack a coconut. That's how
that is terrifying. They are.
Yeah, it is.
It's funny, though. In Costa Rica, we ran across like bunches and bunches of red, and I thought they were spiders in the road, and I was terribly freaked out. And then they were crabs, and it's like, oh, they're just crabs. Oh, and yeah. I don't know why in my brain, when you go from spider to crab, it suddenly gets much better.
You're absolutely right, because that's exactly what I
know where crab and I are on the food chain.
Yes. Yeah. So these were fascinating. I'd never heard of coconut crabs or seen them. Actually, one of the cool things, speaking of like kind of snorkeling and the reefs and even the wildlife around there, on our ship, we always have an expedition team and they're experts in certain specialties.
Right, sure.
We had a marine biologist and they taught us all about coral sea, et cetera, and what we would see. But we also had two people on the expedition team that were producers of a bunch of the BBC, like Planet Earth and Oceans films, which was so cool because like we'd go and we saw coconut crabs on Tetapare Island. And then you'd go back that evening and they would be like, oh, hey, we produced a video or we produced a movie on coconut crabs. And then we could see it. It was really cool. So it backed it up with a really interesting education. Other than that, the snorkeling was really great. Sometimes we would do it off the Zodiac and sometimes you could just walk out from the beach, which was really nice. So all levels of snorkeling were available, I would say. There were some places that if you were comfortable doing like the duck dives in snorkeling, you could dive down and see some of the World War II. There was a fighter plane that had crashed and you could dive down and snorkel around that, depending on how clear and so on it was. And then we would go to these, we would just Zodiac off to these little remote, tiny islands, like just a little piece of sand in the middle of nowhere. And there would be beautiful reefs off of that. Yeah, it was pretty fascinating to see. And then lots of times the villagers, because the other thing about this area is they're so remote villages that these people have not seen visitors for years. Of course, at least 2.5 years because of COVID, but they're already so remote that like most of them have been way more than 2.5 years. So word would get out. It was kind of like, it reminded me of India in that sense. Word would get out and all the people from the villages, any of the nearby villages would actually journey to come see us and potentially also share their handicrafts and stuff like that, which are quite elaborate, and yet there's nothing from China. Let me just put it that way. They're beautiful. So you'd often have a whole bunch of people like get in their canoes and come out to the island just to watch us and hang out, which was really fun. Yeah, it was. And canoes were the main form of transport there for the people who lived on the coast, and they were all wood, hand-carved wood, very super narrow, people who do not have hips, canoes. But that actually brings up a good point. So the thing about people not visiting for a while. Like there was one place we went, Low Island in Vanuatu, that they hadn't had visitors since 2016. Huh. And they put on a beautiful presentation for us and then let us walk around the village. But like, I kept on thinking as I'm looking at all these kids there in the village and they're just, everyone just stares at you. You have to be very used to being stared at.
Yeah.
And you're, for good reason.
You're very unusual looking
from, oh my gosh, yes,
point of view. Yeah.
Yeah. For those kids, we were the first visitors, white people, Caucasians, right, whatever they had
well,
seen.
Well, and those who don't know Sherry, she is blonde or pink.
Yes, mood, I do. Have, yes. I did have a lot of looks at my pink hair. Lots of the women were like fascinated with that. Yeah. It's quite a activity for all of these villages. Sure. It wasn't just when we'd go visit, it wasn't just that village of 100 people. There would be hundreds of people that would come from other villages. And sometimes, like I said, travel for multiple days to just come and watch. Hmm. Not only us, but I think here's the other important piece is they came to watch the festivities too. Okay. Because they don't do this every day. They're not doing these elaborate dances, right, and costumes. Right. And there was a dragon dance and a crocodile dance and a tree frog dance. And like, they don't get to see it either. And one of the things that I really loved about what we did when we visited these areas, because of course, this can be a bit of a touchy subject. You're doing tourism in these remote areas.
Is sure.
that really a good idea? But one of the things we did every time is our expedition leader would make a presentation and we would donate school supplies typically. In addition to these places where we stopped do get paid, obviously, too, for us to make the landing. But we would always give school supplies. But he would always talk about the importance of them holding on to their traditions.
Right.
And ensuring that they are teaching the young people of their village, of their world, these traditions so that they could hold on to them. And that was the really cool thing to see. I loved watching the Sing Sings, but every so often, if you take a step back and you watched, I would watch the crowd,
right,
and the children were just like enraptured with all of this. They hadn't seen a lot of it before either. And there were always little kids that would participate too that right. were super cute, but there were plenty of people also there with mobile phones, even though they don't really have an internet connection. They use them right. more to just communicate
camera
with their
phone.
Family.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were taking video and phones, not necessarily of us, but of the festivities.
Right.
And so it was a reason for all of these people to come out and share this again, which I think is really important.
When we talk about that, there are some controversy and some care needs to be given so that cultural tourism doesn't turn into a zoo kind of thing. Come see the unusual people. But I was just at TBEX, the Travel Blog Exchange Conference, which Sherry and I met at. No, we met
in person at. Yeah.
But we met in person at for the first time. And they were doing a presentation from an Asia, Pan-Asia tourism board. And they were talking about cultural tourism. And they said one of the reasons why the villages put emphasis and importance on this is that a lot of them find the kids are moving away and into the city yeah. because they don't value these old traditions. And when they see that other people are coming to see it, then mm-hmm. it makes it more valuable for them and it makes it something they're more interested in learning. And so it is a way of protecting or preserving at least some of these traditions. So it's a balance because
yeah.
you do get the cultural boma in Tanzania where everybody's in their costume and then they get in their pickups and ride back to wherever they really live.
So, exactly. Yeah.
And it doesn't make it less valuable, but it does make it, there's the question of authentic, you know, well, is it authentic? Yeah. But if you had the chance of buying a pickup and you lived as a semi-nomadic herder, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. And yes, it is. It's a bit of a controversial subject, but I do believe there are ways to do this kind of tourism correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a better word. Thank you. And I do believe that we adhered to that. I do believe that bringing all these people out and giving them reasons to share this culture, as well as financial reasons for them, is all very valuable. And just as you well know, travel, anytime you can interact, you can have two different cultures interact, whether that's just them looking at you and taking you all in and vice versa, your education grows. And that's really important. Yeah. And so that's why I said, like, you're all over the spectrum on that, like how westernized or advanced they were, which was really interesting to see. But the majority of everywhere we visited, like I said, though, still didn't have lights, power, you know, power.
Right. Running water. Water was go send somebody to run, get water.
They collected rain. They had all these elaborate ways to collect the rain off the,
I'm sure that makes sense.
Off the roofs. And so that was really interesting. But yeah, the other thing though, that I think is important is that most of the people that we met really seemed happy. And in fact, one of the chiefs said, we live a simple life and you may think that's different, but he said, but we are all very happy. And I thought that was interesting. The other thing, I met a woman that in one of the small villages, and she was, they were retired. Her and her husband were retired, and her husband used to be a judge on the new court in Papua New Guinea and Port Moresby. So they had lived a very westernized life, I would say. Probably had things, et cetera. But they chose to retire out on this remote island with no running water, no electricity. They had a beautiful little set of thatch houses that she kept meticulous. And they had the money to travel. Like, she had been to the U.S. and I talked to her for a while about her travels, but they chose to be there. And I think that's important, right? I think it's important to realize that when we look at that life, it's not necessarily that everyone wants to get out and leave it. In fact, I thought it was interesting that they retired back to it. Made me think about a lot of stuff.
Excellent. And now, you promised my parents, culture and snorkeling and then history.
History, yes. That was my big surprise. History, the World War II history. Not even just World War II history, but some of the history of that region. So I think it was the Solomon Islands, like I said. That was where JFK's PT-109, I think it's called, was sunk. And he and a couple of people I know, it was fatal. And then they had a whole group that was rescued by these people called the Coast Watchers, which I had never heard of before, but
the Australian Coast Watchers.
World War II. There were a few monuments to the Coast Watchers, et cetera. And there were things like this that we could learn about. We toured Rabaul.
Well, it wasn't just the Coast Watchers who were predominantly Australians, maybe some Kiwis in there also, that were stationed in these remote islands to see who was coming and going with a radio. But they also had, as I recall, some of the native people took a coconut with a message on it to to the Coast Watchers. So they were aided by the locals.
And the Coast Watchers were interesting in because they were really the only ones that could get up into these highlands because it's so dense and so hard to traverse that they could get up there and keep an eye out, basically, and then communicate back via whatever way. So a very important part of the war in that area that we learned about.
We're talking about a fairly early on in World War II for the American involvement. The war had started before us and without us.
Yes.
But we're talking like 42 or so, where the U.S. goes into, I think it's 42, we go into Guadalcanal, which is the kind of the first big offensive where the Marines come in and don't have overwhelming skill, experience, or firepower yet to be able to take this island. And the story goes that the Marines basically say, if they're ever sent to hell, they've already been there, basically. The Guadalcanal was a terrible, brutal fight where the Americans would rule the day and the Japanese would resupply at night, sending ships down the slot, this street that goes down through the islands. And so the Coast Watchers, for instance, one of their jobs is, hey, here come enemy ships are coming in, new troop ships or new supply ships or whatever. And at this point in the war, the U.S. has a very tenuous hold on the island, as later on in the war, the U.S. will have overwhelming firepower and naval supremacy, but it's not that way at this point in the conflict.
The first island we stopped at where we could see some of that war history was Rabaul.
Oh, sure, sorry. Yeah.
So we stopped there. Not only is it a beautiful volcanic island, right, where we learned about all that, but we stopped at some bunkers. That was actually where Yamamoto took off from, and then he was shot down over Bougainville.
Yeah, and Admiral Yamamoto, yeah.
Yeah. So we actually went to his bunkers, and we went to a little area where it was their main headquarters, where they were operating out of, which was interesting. So down in the bunkers, there were like all these maps carved on the walls, and it was fascinating. And then we also visited some areas where they dug, when I say they, this is the prisoners of war, dug out tunnels, like far up, I don't know, a mile or so from the coast, and they would, in a railway that they built, and they would bring cargo from these ships, and they would store them in the tunnels so that they wouldn't get destroyed in air raids and stuff. It was nuts. But yeah. And then there were a few like war relic museums on Rabaul, okay, that were really interesting. They also happened to have a live crocodile there, which was not from the war, but was okay, interesting. Random, I know. But there's some people there that have collected a lot of the war history. One of my favorite war stories, though, was just a conversation I had with a woman in, I can't remember the name of the island. Oh, Nisan Island in Papua New Guinea. And I just went up to her. We were walking around her village, and I went up to her and I happened to ask her, I'm like, what do you carry in your bag? Because they all have these like little purses made out of banana leaves and so on. Anyway, I asked her what she carried, and she said, oh, and she starts rifling through it, and she's a bottle. And the bottle was an old Coca-Cola bottle from that era, World War II, and it would have been left behind from military there. And she's, you need to feel this bottle. And she hands it to me. And the bottle is just one of those little mini ones, right? Is so heavy.
Right. And she's fairly like, substantial.
Yeah. And she's, this is the best bottle ever. She's, it will never break. I can crack coconuts with this bottle. And then she gets out, she's, and now the bottles, she's, they don't make them like they used to. And she gets out another Coke bottle, and she has me hold that one, and it's a newer one, and it's, of course, way lighter, et cetera. I just thought the whole thing was hilarious, because that was the last thing I expected her to pull out of her purse, but I guess, or her bag.
Wouldn't have been on my top 10 list, yeah.
Yeah. But she's, oh, she's like, these bottles, they're the best. They don't make them like this anymore. And I'm like, oh my gosh. But yeah, I thought that was really cute. So because of the war and the stuff that went on there, like we built, or we, the Australians, the New Zealanders, built a lot of airstrips there.
Sure.
And so the little, what do I want to say? The little infrastructure that existed on these islands were because of normally the war, honestly. The final place we stopped that had to do with war history was Luganville in Vanuatu.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so you might have heard of that because that was a big U.S. military presence. They had, right, a safe harbor there that we had put all kinds of mines in, and accidentally actually blew up one of our own ships, apparently, or a ship that went in the wrong entrance and was blown up. But mm-hmm, people survived. Anyway, they had...
And that's on Espiritu Santo.
Yes, it is. Yeah, so there was a huge military presence there. And also, because of that, it's probably one of the more developed islands we went to. So we stopped at some of the sites there. One of the most disturbing, yeah, it really was disturbing, was something they call Million Dollar Point. I don't know if you've heard of that, which was...
No.
So when we pulled out, when everything was over, we had all this equipment there. And I believe the French might have been there too. The French and the UK and British troops might have been there too.
Okay. But
some European troops. And I'm not real clear why we didn't want to give it to them, but we had no way to get all this stuff back. So in the end, they dumped all of this equipment, like cars, everything, in the ocean, in the bay, basically. And now it is all resting there, and you can snorkel around it if you like, but they call it Million Dollar Point. So the Americans didn't want anyone, they didn't want the Japanese to get it, they didn't want anyone to get it, and they just dumped it. It looks like, so anyway, and there was really nothing much to see unless you bring a snorkel and get in the water. They had a little like sign commemorating it, but you will read a lot about it. And yeah, that was a really interesting little stop. In addition to that, on that island, they had some really great swimming and blue holes and stuff like that. But Luganville was an interesting little town and stop for the war. Yeah, so I learned a lot about World War II there. And there's, we actually had on the ship, we had a historian that was specialized in World War II. So if you had any questions, you could just ask him, which was pretty fascinating. And he did a number of talks on it too. So yeah, it was really an educational trip for me in all sorts of ways.
Okay, so we've got culture, snorkeling, history, and what was your fourth one? You had four categories.
I know.
Bird watchers.
Yeah, actually, we did talk a little bit about that, but
I think that was your
fourth. That might have been birding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned birding, yeah. And you didn't say the birds were fascinating. You said the birders were fascinating.
Birders are always fascinating. Yes. So I did not go out on any of the specific birding expeditions.
Okay.
But every day they would be the first to leave off the ship because they had to get out early, obviously. You wouldn't be there when the sun comes up. So they were often leaving at 4 a.m.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Oh yeah. On zodiacs and would take off and would be gone pretty much all day until we had to pull up anchor and move on. So they had, or Heritage kind of offers a special birding package, I guess I would call it. Just kind of a little extra because you have a bird specialist with you, and then you're going out and meeting local bird specialists from the islands, which is basically a villager who knows where to find them, etc. Yeah, lots of interest, and they were great. They were on the islands and they would share all their birding photos with us. But what was I going to say? It's different. When I talked to all the birders, they did say this part of the world is a birder's paradise because there's so many different species, but they're very hard to see and find because they have been hunted. Sure. Lots of the birds have been hunted, which is why it's also so hard to find birds of paradise, which you'll find in Papua New Guinea. But anyway, so they're pretty skittish and they seem to have the best luck in some of the islands that we went to. There were two islands that were like conservation areas.
Okay.
So Tetapare was one of them. Kalambangara was another. So yeah, it was really interesting. We also did spend a day cruising down the Sepik River in Papua New Guinea, which is a very, probably the most well-known river in that region. But so we did a little zodiac cruise there and we were able to see a number of birds. The ones I recognized were herons, but there were plenty of other ones, plenty. Then the other piece of birding is we're moving from island to island, normally in the afternoon or something like that. And so you could also, a lot of the birders would just hang out right on the bow with their binoculars and big lenses. And you would see a bunch of the seabirds coming along with us. Yeah.
And I'm curious, are the islands close enough together that you didn't have days at sea, that there was always an island every day?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. They were really close. Like we would really just travel at night for the most part, sometimes in the afternoon, but the majority of the time we were traveling at night, we would show up and the anchor would be getting dropped at 6 a.m. and we would be out by 7:30 typically. Oh. Yeah. This is not a cruise where you sleep in.
Yeah. Unless you're, especially if you're a birder. So,
oh gosh, no. And then the birders of course kept a whole species list and would present to us at night too. And so we could see what they were seeing. So yeah, it was a big group and always interesting people to talk to.
See, I'm surprised as a photographer, you were not sucked into that when you started to see their pictures or something.
But it does make me, here's the thing though, bird photography like that takes years to perfect and it's much harder than it looks. So for me, just going out once, it would have been hard to get good pictures, but I'll let other people do that. Excellent. I prefer the hiking. We did a bunch of hiking and stuff too, which I love, in the rainforest and so on. Yes.
Excellent. As we start to look towards wrapping this up, what else do people need to know if they're going to do a trip like this or this particular trip?
One good thing is you can taste the local food, but you eat really well on the ship. So the local food is pretty basic, They mainly feast off of sago, which is a palm tree that they go out and gather. And then it's this whole process of breaking it down. It's basically a starch or a flour. And then that gets mixed with coconut oil and stuff like that. There's lots of coconuts. There's taro. There's sweet potato. They just roast it over the fire and eat it with what they call spinach, which is something green that's been cooked in these bamboo shoots. It's kind of like their pots, which is really cool. I'm like, wow, that's a neat idea. I'm surprised that hasn't taken hold somehow here. So even though we were exposed to their food and we could taste it all, at least we could go back and have really good food on the ship. But it does make you appreciate it. Like, they're just using what they have around them, and that's it. Other things to know, it is hot, so be ready. You're near the equator. It is hot and humid. It took me a while to adjust to the heat, and you are sitting out just in the open watching these sing-sings. Lots of times they would try to gather you all in a certain spot in the village where they do these presentations, and that tended to be under a large, like 100-year-old tree, which was beautiful, actually. I always loved that. It was like the natural meeting point of the villages. But still, it is hot. One nice thing to help with that a little bit is they always have an ample supply of coconuts. Literally just, hey, you want a coconut? Machete off the top. And
here, let me take my Coke bottle and open up a coconut for you.
Oh my God. So yeah, that was always really nice. Other things to know. Gosh, this sounds weird, but maybe you can relate since you've gone on expedition cruises before. It's also really interesting meeting your other cruisers, your fellow cruisers, because they come from all walks of life. And so it's a social way to travel in a way. Mm-hmm. You meet these people from all over the world, from all walks of life. And generally what I've found on expedition cruises is that the people who are into them do multiple ones. So like this was the most well-traveled group of people I have ever met.
Well,
ever.
It's not an inexpensive cruise. So we're talking about $10,000 or something like that.
For 17 per person. Days.
Yeah, for 17 days. So you tend to meet people who can't afford that.
Yes,
so they often have had interesting careers. They tend to be late in careers or retired is my experience.
Yep, a lot of retired.
But early retired with energy.
Active.
Yeah. And yeah, this one's a judge. This one's a doctor. This one, whatever. And yeah, very well traveled is my experience as well. You don't really do the trip to London and Paris and then go down to Melanesia. That is, there's usually a few trips in between there.
Yeah. Oh my God. They've been everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. Very good points. This isn't for everyone. I will say that.
No, but it is a fascinating group of people. When you, there's something about people who are adventuresome tend, in my experience, to be more fun to hang out with than, for instance, when I was on the big boat cruise and we stopped in the rainforest and someone was complaining that it was raining. Rains 360 days a year, but you thought it wouldn't for you. You don't tend to get that kind of whiny person on this kind of experience, because they usually it's somebody who's got a sense of adventure and is willing to sit under the big tree in the heat and watch the thing, or maybe wear the blue loincloth
or wear the blue loincloth or go out in the rain on a Zodiac cruise you will be exposed to a lot. But it takes a certain type of traveler to want to do this, without a doubt. And that traveler is definitely me. But which is why I love it so much. But you're right. The cost is higher. It's one of the higher, more kind of epic trips that you're going to do, probably. Sure. But as I said, it's 17 days and all your food and all you have to do is get there, which is not easy either. That was expensive to get flights out there. And just the time. I went out days ahead just because I had so many different connections to try to get there.
Right.
That I didn't want to miss any of them.
Right.
Or have some, you want to build yourself a little bit of a buffer.
Right. Just in case you do miss a flight, you don't want to miss the boat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the other thing I would say, which is a little weird because I'm not really a shopper, but another thing to know about the area is if you're into, I don't know, South Pacific relics.
Okay.
There's lots of shopping to be done. Shopping, meaning families come and set up their hand wood carvings that you can buy, or their gourds, or their, I don't know, coconut grass skirts or whatever. But actually, it's a lot of really intricate, beautiful carvings and detailed handwork, like things that take months to make. So the only hard part about that is if you do want to buy some of that stuff, you have to make sure you can get it back.
Okay.
So luckily we had someone on the ship that was, I'm going to say, expert at a bunch of that. And she would know the rules, like going into Australia, if we could take that in. So anytime, I didn't buy much, I bought a couple little souvenirs, but I would always go to her and be like, can I get this back to America through Australia? And she's like, yes or no. Yeah. But there were people that were really, that were collectors and so on. And this is stuff that you will not find anywhere. And
interesting.
As I said, it would be when people found out that the ship was landing or whatever, or arriving for that day, all these different people would come down from different villages also to try to sell some of their wares and stuff like that too. Yeah. So that was really fascinating too.
Excellent. Well, Sherry-Aunt, if we start to wrap this up and I asked you where the prettiest spot was that you saw in Melanesia, where would we be talking about? Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
I would say Lily's Island, which was in the Solomon Islands, I believe. And it was
which I assume is named after our friend Lily Marshall.
I don't know who Lily was.
Okay.
But it was an island name I could remember. No. It was, what made it so cool is it was the tiniest little strip of sand island I had ever seen. And I actually was stunned when we were in the Zodiac and I'm like, we're going there? Like literally, there were a few palm trees and just little bits of sand.
Got out of the cartoons of the two castaways standing on the island with the palm tree. Okay.
So I think that was just one of those moments where it all came together for me where I'm like, oh my God, like this really is different and remote. And it was beautiful. The colors of the water were just beautiful, clear, but that beautiful turquoise. So that was probably from a beauty standpoint. I'm a big fan of sunsets off the boat too, or sunsets anywhere for that matter. We normally happen to be traveling at that time. So it was normally on the boat. But yeah, I think that was probably from a beauty standpoint.
Okay.
My favorite.
And then besides the Coke bottle in the purse, one thing that makes you laugh and say only in Melanesia.
Oh. I'll say the welcomings that we got, like the fact that you pull up on a Zodiac and you've got, or in a truck and you've got all these people rushing out at you with spears and arrows. That has only happened to me in Melanesia for sure.
Excellent.
It was fun. It was really fun.
And our guest again has been Sherry-Aunt from ottsworld.com. And Sherry, if we want to send people to your best post on Melanesia, have you got that written up yet? Or is that
still coming? I have not written it yet. I just got back. If they want to see right away, though, I have a highlight on my Instagram account that is the Melanesia trip, and have created a whole bunch of, so you can see the dances, the video, like the water instruments and all of that stuff, if you just look at that Melanesia highlight. And then I will be following it up with some writing.
Your Instagram, as I recall.
Yes, at OttsWorld is my Instagram.
And I should say, I thought when we started this interview, before we started recording, that we were actually going to end up talking about last week's show of Nebraska, because I mentioned it to Sherry. And she started relating that her nieces had worked at the haunted hayride and
at Roca Farm.
At Roca Farm. So I thought we were going to do a repeat show, but I appreciate that you came on and we didn't talk about Nebraska, but we did talk about the Melanesia, Sherry. And thank you for sharing with us your love for Melanesia, your newfound love for Melanesia.
My newfound love, yes. I hope it resonates with some people and you will consider go seeing this part of the world, because it's absolutely unique and fascinating, and I don't think there's any way you can't love it and the people.
I'd like to thank the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially. If you'd like to become a patron of the show or just want to know what it involves and what you'd get, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler and learn more. I often say that this is one of those shows that you really need to make sure that you've got a version of a podcatcher that can show the chapters and the graphics. But this is really one of those shows where you've got to see some of the pictures that Sherry is talking about, because they're pretty awesome, especially the pictures of the Sing Sing and the costumes that people are wearing. And so remember, again, there are certain podcatchers, certain programs that you use to play a podcast. I use Downcast, for instance, on the iPhone, that will show you those pictures of everything we talk about. And remember also that you need to download the show within the first month that it comes out, or you need to be a patron of the show to see those chapters. Because once we start inserting ads after a month, unfortunately, the insertion of the ads gets in the way of the chapters. So remember to subscribe to the show so you always get the new ones and always get, therefore, the version with the chapters in it. And then also, if you forget about something, you'd always join the Patreon for a month and go grab some old show or something like that. Or just let me know and we can see what we can do. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.
Help your small business thrive and stay connected with the Comcast Business Complete Connectivity Solution. It's the largest, fastest, reliable network. Advanced gig speed Wi-Fi and cyber threat protection. Get started for just $40 a month for 12 months with no annual contract when you add mobile. Plus, ask how to get up to a $750 prepaid card. Comcast Business, powering possibilities.
Ends 2/21/2023. Restrictions apply. Requires EcoBill and AutoPay. New 100 megabits per second internet and Comcast Business Security Edge customers only. Equipment taxes and fees extra. After 12 months, regular rates apply. Gig internet required for gig Wi-Fi.